talk radio about all things all genders. This is Intravenous, live on CJSF 90.1 FM, discussing and approaching contemporary gender issues through a feminist lens. Our goal is to educate, engage, and challenge the dominant hegemony.
Good morning, everyone, and welcome to Intravenous here on CJSF 90.1 FM Burnaby Campus and Community Radio from Simon Fraser University, where we are located on the ancestral and unceded homelands of the Halkomelem and Squamish-speaking peoples. You can listen online at cjsf.ca or on our radio app, which you can download from the app or Google Play Store, depending on your device. And you can text or call in at 778-782-2573. I am Rebecca, and I'm going to be your host for the next hour up until 11 a.m., where Democracy Now! Will then take over. I hope you're all having a lovely Wednesday morning or afternoon, lunchtime. It may not even be Wednesday when you're listening to this, but wherever you are, I hope you're having a good day or you've had a good day and you're having a great week. I mean, we're halfway through, so I hope you're all having a great time. I'm going to put a trigger warning right at the start here for this episode, as this is part two to my discussion with Dr. Dominic Wilmot, where we are discussing rape and serious sexual offence cases. So there will be talk of rape, there will be talk of sexual assault cases, there will be discussions on rape myths and case details. So if that is not something that you want to be listening to, or it may be triggering to you, I would strongly advise that you tune out, and you can tune back in at 11 a.m. for Democracy Now! And you can always put another Intravenous episode on. You can go to the Intravenous playlist on cjsf.ca, and there is plenty to choose from if you want your weekly dose of women and gender talk on the radio. So yes, like I said, this is part two of my interview with Dominic Wilmot. This is part of my mini-series, which is exploring structural issues impacting survivor justice for rape and serious sexual offence cases. We started off a couple weeks ago with my discussion with Leonie, who was the CEO of the registered charity Justice Is Now in the UK. And then last week we heard, obviously, part one of my discussion with my professor from Loughborough University, Dr. Dominic Wilmot. And then next week is the final, I guess, part of my mini-series, which will be my panel discussion with Chloe, Jacqueline, and Patty, who are all collaborating on a research project here in Canada looking at Northern BC, Northern Ontario, and the Yukon in regard to an accessibility crisis for sexual assault evidence collection kits. So that will be next week's episode. It's a really interesting discussion, so I encourage you all to tune in again next Wednesday from 10 a.m. But like I said, this is part two of my discussion with Dom. So a recap of what was discussed in part one, which I would recommend listening to if you didn't manage to catch it last week. It was a very interesting discussion, but we spoke a bit about conviction to acquittal rates. We spoke a bit about survivors believing and internalizing rape myths, what a rape myth is. We addressed legal professionals and jurors using rape myths. We pulled apart the justice process and the impact it has on the complainant. We looked a bit at why rape cases are more complex, the role gender is playing in which rape myths are being believed by who, and how this can link to the gender of the complainant. And we finished off with beginning to discuss the deficit in Canadian research, which we will continue at the start of part two airing today. We look at a little bit of murdered and missing Indigenous women and girls and Two-Spirit people. We look at the criminal justice systems not being open to being researched. There's no formal acceptance that there's an issue. We look at some potential solutions to juror bias and rape myths, and we hone in on a couple of them, like judge-only trials, the role of expert witnesses. We look at the role of social desirability, the subconscious bias, and we kind of break apart two different concepts that are used in the trial process: the concept of beyond reasonable doubt when it comes to jurors convicting. We look a bit about pitfalls in juror comprehension, misinterpretation of the law, trauma and PTSD of jurors. We then also look at the concept of innocent until proven guilty, linking it to the misconception of women lying about rape and high acquittal rates. We then go in a bit on Dom's experience working in this field and navigating the space due to how heavy and serious this topic is, and how rape myths should be combated through education and consent education, and the role the media is playing in reinforcing rape myths. And then we finish up with my question to Dom being, will there ever be a jury without bias? Which he kind of answers, and I'm not going to tell you the answer, you'll have to listen, but he talks a bit about juror screening and restricting barristers' use of rape myths in there. So that is what part two will be going in on this morning, and as it is quite a heavy topic, I would like to start off with a song. So I'm going to start off with this song, Out of the City, by McLean, who is a Canadian female artist. She's sort of indie folk and indie rock. I was mixing the two words. And it's off of the album Off the Deep End. So I hope you guys all enjoy the song, and I will catch you right after for my discussion with Dom.
The walls are closing in now, anxiety creeping in. How am I never able to control this? Looks like they laid the path out, conform and follow this route. Why picket fence and work my life away? Oh, I don't know why we're half alive, too numb to realize there's a way out of this. Oh, I gotta get out. Again, hood up and earbuds in. I live this day before a thousand times. But working for the weekend don't sit right with my spirit. I wanna make art full heart feel human. Oh, I don't know why we're half alive, too numb to realize there's a way out of for months now. It's been raining nonstop now, and my apartment is empty, and my friends, they don't get me, and I got this anxiety and these thoughts that won't leave me. I wanna be Are you free? Are you free? Are you free? Do you wanna be free with me? Are you free? Are you free? Are you free? Do you wanna be free with me?
Yeah, and I think especially because they have the added kind of issue of the force, the driving force for truth and reconciliation with the Indigenous peoples, and they are a group that is targeted the most when it comes to sexual violence and things. And there is a movement which is the Murdered and Missing Indigenous Women and Two-Spirit Girls, in which I'm not the most educated person on this, but there was a 2019 national inquiry into it, which as far as I know, not a lot has changed in response to that. And it's still like a big prominent issue. One of the people that I've interviewed, that I'm going to be doing a panel interview with them actually this week, in regard to their current research, in that they focus on geographical accessibility for Indigenous women and girls in northern BC, Yukon and northern Ontario in regard to forensic evidence collection. Because even if they wanted to report straight away, they don't have the option to. And also the processes are not informed in the Indigenous ways of life. And they have a completely different system when it comes to healthcare, anything medical. They have a whole different process to healing than Western medicine. And these approaches don't cater towards that at all. So I know that's a whole, they have like a whole other layer that we don't really have in the UK as another issue to be dealing with when it comes to this area. And I don't know much about like loads of research going into that. I just know about their paper, and that's been going on. They only managed to get funding from that in 2023. So they're, I think it's going up until 2026, I want to say. So they're like halfway, just over halfway through it. So even then, it's going to be very like current stuff. There's not going to be a lot that's already out for people to read and for it to have been completed.
And the other challenge is we're talking about these things like the systems are open and willing to be researched, and that's also not the case, right? They're often closed and very difficult. Across the world, juries are pretty much off limits for research, hence why we have to do these realistic mock jury studies. And so it's not even, you know, we know there's a problem, and there's lots of academic research from gender-based violence scholars around the world, and some fantastic NGOs, and even individuals like yourself, Rebecca, who are doing this show that's focusing on these issues and giving it the spotlight it deserves. But there are people in positions of power, especially within our justice organisations, that are not as open, not as accepting of the evidence that there is an actual issue. And so, you know, so I often get asked, what is the kind of primary objectives of your jury research? Part of it is generating robust evidence that makes it difficult for policymakers to challenge that there is actually a problem. The second phase that lots of people are working on are solutions. So, you know, I look at things like, would educating jurors, would rape myth debunking training work? Would it be better coming from a judge or a psychologist? Would it be better delivered via video training or leaflet? You know, all these sorts of kind of interventions. The truth is that at the minute, that's largely academic debate and scholarly activity, because justice organisations, policymakers, politicians are still stuck at a position that really 40 years ago we knew we already had evidence of. That is, these myths and stereotypes do impact police, prosecutors and jurors in a detrimental, negative way. But there's still a resistance to accepting that, because a formal acceptance means reform, and in some cases, radical reform. Do we simply get rid of jurors? Do we replace jurors with judges? Do we intervene in some way? What does that mean in terms of the safety of convictions? Does everyone who's been convicted before a jury in a rape case now get a right to a retrial? Does every complainant who didn't get a conviction, an acquittal, do they get a second shot? Do they get to go back to trial? So the consequences of formal acceptance by our justice organisations and our political leaders that there is a problem mean that they're likely to be very resistant to ever accepting there's a problem. And so that's why we see these small incremental steps in the right direction that for people like us can be quite frustrating, because we know there's a problem. We've known for 40 years there's a problem in this regard. And we've got a good degree of insight into what those solutions might look like. But those that can affect that change, that can implement those solutions, are not with us. And so, yeah, that's the other issue.
Yeah, and you've mentioned there so many aspects I want to talk to you about in potential reforms and potential solutions. And I think one that I'm very interested in, because I spoke to Leonie about this in our discussion, and she said she had a differing stance to you on it, is the use of judge-only trials. And I know that there was a pilot scheme in Scotland that has since been scrapped on trialing judge-only trials for rape and sexual assault cases, and what your views are as that being a solution to reduce rape myth bias because of jury decision-making.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, it's a great question, great point. So I personally believe, so will abolishing jurors deal with the problem of jury rape myth bias? By virtue of the fact there's no longer jurors, yes, it absolutely will. My concern is that we replace one form of bias with another. And, you know, let's be honest, judges tend to be quite a homogenous group. They tend to be a bunch of, no offense, judges out there, old, rich, white guys. And with them comes a certain type of stereotype and attitude towards women and towards what normal traditional sex looks like. And there's a lot of blame attribution towards female rape complainants in particular. So my concern is that if we abolish jurors, who at least to some degree come from the, you know, by virtue of definition, they're supposed to come from the same background, society, community, as those who are both victimized and accused of the crime. That's the point of them. At least they have some understanding. We also know high prevalence rates mean that lots of jurors will have first-hand experience of sexual violence themselves. So my concern is that judges from their ivory towers will be making decisions in cases that their lives are probably never, it's never, you know, there's no degree of overlap between their own lives there. And the section of society they come from means that they may struggle to understand the experiences of victim survivors and those involved, you know, both the accused and the complainant. So now and again, we hear from high profile cases, judges make remarks like, you might have seen this in Ireland when there was a high profile rape case involving sports figures there. The judge said something along the lines of, she was wearing lacy underwear and therefore clearly she wanted to have sex, like that's some sort of prerequisite for consent. So yeah, judges don't tend to take part in these sorts of studies, so we don't know exactly their beliefs, but by virtue of the fact they're including comments, their summary instructions and post conviction, their opinions are often reported in the press. We do see examples of their own stereotypes bleeding through. And so that's my main concern with that. I think, you know, we get rid of jury bias because there's no longer jurors, but do we just replace it with judicial bias? I think there's a strong chance we do.
Yeah, because I spoke about this on my show a couple weeks ago with one of my friends when we were discussing judge versus jury only trials, because it just been announced about the Canadian hockey trial over here being judge only. And I spoke about that similarly, do we just replace it with another bias? Because like you said, you look at the statistics and it is a lot of old white men that are in the judicial system in England and Wales. But also if you look at the average custodial sentence lengths, in terms of, there are statistics done by the Ministry of Justice, and I believe it was in 2022, they had another round of it and they split it in different ethnicity groups. And you look at it and it seemed that for indictable offences, that white group had the lowest average custodial length compared to, I want to say the highest was Asians. And I think it was like a 10-month gap. So you already see in the statistics there that there is a kind of a bias when it comes to sentencing, which is down to a judge, not a jury.
Yeah. Yeah.
So if you follow that route of like, well, there might be a potential bias there, if you look, deduce that from the statistics, putting them in the situation of deciding verdicts for rape and sexual assault cases, what actually stops them from putting in their own bias?
Yeah, and the truth is nothing. They're accountable to no one, really. That they are the judge. And so they, you know, higher courts can appeal decisions, but that happens in a very small number of cases. You need something really, robust for that to happen. And, you know, jurors will often say, I didn't disbelieve the complainant. I wasn't using myths and stereotypes. We just found there wasn't enough evidence. And then I listen back to the deliberative recordings and they're littered with biases. So there's this other issue that biases are not always within our conscious awareness. And also social desirability means we don't often admit them. If you ask a racist juror or a racist judge if they're racist, they're going to tell you no. And, you know, how often do we hear people say things like, I'm not racist, but... So if you ask those people, they often have deeply held belief that they're not racist, even when making racist remarks. So rapists operate very similar to racist attitudes in that way. They're deeply held. They often sit below conscious awareness. There is also another issue here, and that's that things could go completely the opposite way. Judges are more case hardened. They convict a ratio of around 25% more than jurors. So jurors convict, let's say jurors, you know, 100% of cases that judges would convict, jurors only convict in 75% of cases. So there is a chance that judges just start convicting larger numbers of people. If that person is guilty, great, they get convicted. But, you know, are they more prone to conviction? Studies across the world tell us judges are more conviction prone than jurors. And so the other thing is, in that pilot in Scotland, and one of my colleagues, Lee Curley, who's a researcher, a jury researcher at Glasgow Caledonian University, I think made this point at the time. They're being evaluated. Like, what does a successful evaluation of this pilot look like? Higher conviction rates? You know, so this is the other thing. Like, how do we determine that this has worked as a pilot? What is success? And so, you know, when we, there's been psychological studies, a slightly different context, but you go into an office environment, and this is like classic psych study, go into an office environment, tell the workers that their performance, productivity has been assessed, and in one group you turn the lights down, in another group you turn the lights up, in one group you turn the heating down, another group you turn the heating up. What you find is productivity across the board increases by virtue of the fact people know they're being evaluated. So this is the other risk. Like, what does success look like? For me, it's about reduction of bias. And the reason I wouldn't say I'm against judge-only trials, because jury bias is a significant problem. But I think before we get there, let's not throw the baby out with the bathwater. There are many things we could do that allow us to retain the democratic safeguard of a jury model and to, you know, give jurors a shot of getting it right by changes to the system and processes. And only when we've saturated all those options and we find they don't work, I think they, some of them will work, should we then look to the final alternative, which is judge-only trials. So, yeah, to go from there's a problem with jurors, let's get rid of them, I think there's lots of things we could do in between that could deal with the problem of jury bias.
So for you, judge-only trials is kind of the almost last hurdle, last resort, after trying everything else, in which it leads me on to actually asking you about what role, because I remember reading this in, I believe it was one of your papers, about the role of expert witnesses and having kind of people on the witness stand that specialize in trauma and explaining how trauma can present itself and things like that, and educating jurors during rape and sexual assault trials, whether it's they're on the stand during the trial or they speak to the jury before the trial or after, how that can be a reform for jury bias. But also, I wanted to question on how you think that could be integrated without risking a fair trial.
Yeah. I mean, there's definitely some complexities around expert witnesses. An obvious one is actually the US style of expert witnesses, which it becomes a battle of the expert. The prosecution hire their expert, the defense hire their expert. They both disagree with each other, and then it brings the expertise into disrepute, like what actually is the known reality here. And a lot of what we're talking about around trauma responses, they of course vary between people. This isn't an exact science. Whilst there is a science to it, different people respond differently to different forms of trauma, and sexual violence is no different. We see a profile, a general profile or a common profile of trauma responses. And, you know, showering after being raped, despite logically keeping that evidence would be the most useful, but you're not thinking evidentially, you're thinking about the awful things just happened to you. So this sort of information, I think, is useful, and it will be presented to jurors to interpret. You know, you have to make sure this expert is given expertise to the court rather than to one side, so it doesn't become battle of the experts. But they're talking about common trauma responses, and therefore it's for the jurors to make use of that and make sense of it if they see fit. So it doesn't necessarily, I would hope in that sense, it wouldn't bias the or impact the right to a fair trial or the opportunity for a fair trial. I just think it's an additional form of insight that they currently don't have. So, you know, it is it by virtue of the fact that we have a misunderstanding about what is a normal response having been raped, and jurors and members of the public's understanding of what is normal is often quite different from what really is normal. In that sense, it's a form of education to jurors, and you know whether they think it's relevant to this trial and this case at hand is for them to decide. But we're at least providing them with a nuanced reality of how people vary in their responses and common responses having been victim of sexual violence. So I think that form of education is useful to them. I know that among some quarters and among some judges, they don't like this idea. They think. Yeah, I mean, they would prefer to give directions themselves rather than an expert come in and talk about what is or isn't normal and common, for the sort of reasons that you mentioned. But yeah, I personally think it could be useful. But there are some challenges around how it's done. Like, who is the list of experts for a start? You know, this is another issue. We're seeing this in the UK with family court, that anybody can call themselves a psychologist and be an expert witness. But there are obviously variability in terms of actual expertise that are relevant to the court. So yeah, how do you then regulate and manage that process? So it's certainly complicated, and like you said with your onion analogy earlier, these things, yeah, with every intervention or solution there are lots of other layers that we then need to get right and work out how this would work in practice.
Yeah, absolutely. I think it's an interesting concept to be kind of explaining straight off the bat at the start of a trial how trauma works and how it can present itself in different ways, because again, I look back at my experience as a juror and that I think that would have been incredibly useful, especially for my first trial, based on what happened in deliberations and where certain jurors were kind of getting the justifications for their reasons, being that there was kind of no one really, I would say, fully understood the level that trauma can present itself in so many different ways. There isn't a set way that trauma presents itself for every single person that is the same. And I think as well, whilst talking about kind of my experiences being on a juror, there is one concept that I think I struggled with the most, which actually came from the judge's instructions, in that I want your kind of opinion on it, in that I again spoke about this with Leonie because we were discussing that this also seems to be a problem that hinders a lot of jurors convicting, in that the standard of beyond reasonable doubt being the threshold.
I knew you were going to say that, yeah.
Being the threshold to convict, because the more I think back to my case, and the more I think of the, because it wasn't, the barristers emphasized that as well, of that you have to be beyond reasonable doubt. But the judge did a lot more than the barristers, in that if you are not beyond reasonable doubt, you have to go not guilty. And it's, how do you measure beyond reasonable doubt?
Yeah. So there's been some developments on this front recently in England and Wales, and we don't actually use beyond reasonable doubt now. We say sure. So you have to be sure. If you're not sure, if you think probably true, probably did it, likely did it, then, you know, so it operates quite similar to beyond reasonable doubt. But the idea is that jurors will be able to apply sure, a sure directive, as it's called, more easily and more readily than this obscure concept of beyond reasonable doubt. But the truth is, from the work we've been doing so far, where we're looking at deliberations, they struggle with sure, you know, as well. And so what is sure? So directions will be, judges will say things like, you're sure of many things every day. I've been sure of many things that have ultimately proved to be incorrect. I was sure that I left at a certain time. I was sure I brought my car keys with me. I was sure I had my wallet in my pocket. And then those things proved to be true. So being certain, being sure, and being correct are two separate things. And so the courts, at least in England and Wales, there is a reluctance to put a numerical figure on this, because... Yeah, actually, in the research I've been doing, I ask jurors to say guilty, not guilty, and then I say, how sure are you? And they define their how sure they are on a continuum, and you see lots of variability. People